You're listening to Arena's Olympiad with me, Sean Rocks, the best of Irish radio arts to keep you company during the Olympic Games. Tonight, we're looking back at some of our best interviews. All the Good Things You Deserve is the fourth poetry collection from Elaine Feeney, a writer probably best known for the novel she published in recent times, As You Were, from 2020, and last year's Booker long-listed How to Build a Boat. In the beginning, however, she produced three poetry collections, Where's Katie, The Radio Was Gospel, and Rise, and we're delighted she's back with new poems. And joining us now from our Galway studio, Elaine, I remember at some stage along the way, I can't remember whether you said, yeah, when you wrote the first novel, I think it was, you said to me, sure, all the money is in the novels, but you
Sean,
found
you
out.
You weren't supposed to say that on the radio.
I think you said it to me on the radio
probably,
at the time.
It's very likely I did, and I was indiscreet as usual.
Yeah, but you found out you were wrong. In fact, all the money is in the poems, and back you went.
I can categorically say that's actually not true, but that's okay.
I guess the two things, I hardly think that you said, I'll write novels now for two or three years and I'll stop and I'll go back and I'll write poetry. I presume the two things have been running along in tandem for that period, Elaine.
Yeah, no, it's actually been quite fascinating. So I published Rise in 2017 and I just couldn't continue with poetry at the time. Yeah. I just felt the eye was so exposing and it was so personal. And I wanted to sort of tell not bigger stories, but maybe stories that had tentacles out into the world and just weren't focused on me. I was very tired of myself. So I actually didn't think I'd ever write another collection after Rise. And I did, weirdly, and I don't even know how I went about it. But anyway, I'm going to try and tease that out.
Yeah, because, I mean, you talked about it, you're talking about the I as in, you know, you yourself,
yeah.
that first person aspect of writing poetry. And this is a familiar arc, I suppose, and, well, it doesn't always happen from trauma to love, but that is the arc that you're following here. And it is very much, it is hugely autobiographical, I'm guessing, and thinking is the case.
Yeah, no, it absolutely is. And I think it took me maybe till this stage in my life to actually maybe write these poems or to maybe reveal myself in this way. And it is, that is the arc of the book, does sort of go from trauma to love or to accepting love or to even trying to write a love poem. But I don't think it's never linear in a way. Yeah. And I think the collection, each of the poems in a way, there's a circularity and they keep circling back on themselves and on memory and on image and so on. But yeah, that's definitely is the arc. But the first poem that we will talk about, the titular poem from the collection, yeah, was obviously a very difficult poem to write for me. But I felt that I had a block with poetry, and when I retrospectively think about it, I think that the whole aesthetic palette of language for a poet comes from childhood and young adulthood and all of that experience. You know, we almost, language predates memory and expression in some ways, I think. And I just had to write this poem and maybe clear the decks in a way, but it made its way in.
It's a long poem, as you say, consisting of, I think I'm just looking for the number here at the
beginning. 24.
24 cantos, thank you very much. Because the final one is actually called Canto Begin Again, 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 Again.
But
24 is the number that you've used here. Mm-hmm. You're dealing with, are telling us the story of, or part of the story of, an abusive relationship. Were you writing this from a distance? Did it take a lot of distance time wise to be able to start to write about this?
Oh yeah, decades really. And what I was doing actually at the time was I was writing the epilogue for How to Build a Boat, interestingly. And if anyone is familiar with that, it kind of moves into a poetic scape. And this poem kept coming and coming and coming, and it was so long and so dense, and oh, I don't know how many words it ended up at. And I wanted it just to go away, but I had to. I was simultaneously, weirdly, writing the two at the same time, and I actually had to finish All the Good Things You Deserve before I could free myself, weirdly, to write the epilogue for How to Build a Boat. So, you know, I've spoken before of intrusive language and, you know, poetry. Often you wait around, you sit and wait for it, and it does come knocking. And that can be a good or a bad thing. And I think, I mean, this is a very contradictory collection You know, life is full of contradictions, and it's sort of, there's a dichotomy in it, in that, like, you know, love and hate exist in the same person, and, you know, happiness and sadness, exploration and solitude. So it is that sort of, it's broken into two sections as well. And like we said,
yeah,
I suppose trauma moving to love, not to put too glib.
Yeah, and then it's not one big linear move from one to the other. That is not what it's about. But to give a sense of it, I mean, Canto 19, sometimes I am all panic and I run out of my house and I run. Running is a constant theme. Looking for every place you went, looking to make sure you knew the way out of the room. Or whatever space you were in, that you knew the exit route if you needed to get to it. I was also struck by the number of times across the 24 cantos that you use the phrase, "I am sorry."
Yeah, I think that'll be familiar to some listeners. And I think, I'm not sure it's particularly a female experience, but I think that I use it almost as a tick. You know, sometimes I preface the beginning of a conversation with "I'm sorry," or, you know, "I'm sorry for taking up space," or "I'm sorry for being in this space." And so I use that strike through technique to sort of delete them, but you can still read them on the page. And it's that thing of trying to re-own my narrative for me. And that was very important with this. I was at the Courage Festival. I launched the collection and the wonderful poet Suzanne Dickey interviewed me. And it was funny, we were discussing this and I said, I think I wrote this experience in poetry so I don't have to defend myself, because I feel that, you know, many people will feel familiar with this. I've spent a lifetime of defending my own narrative, which, you know, is very much the point of the poem in many ways, is that actually I'm going to free it with poetry. Yeah. And, you know, MacNeice, who's mentioned in the poem, Louis MacNeice, said something, I'm going to paraphrase, but it was, "I'm not offering a final verdict. You can't expect that of poets." And I really like that poetry allows me a space, or allows me air, or allows me time, actually, for consideration.
Yeah, well, it allows the reader a lot of time for consideration as well. Mm-hmm. That opening section is one that I definitely will be going back to, because it really struck me, even on a first, second and third reading. Let us go to one of the pieces then from a little bit later into the book, "Did Anyone Whistle?" You're looking at County Galway here.
Yeah, and I'm taking it away from the eye for a minute.
Yeah.
But I was commissioned to respond to Murphy's A Whistle in the Dark for the Abbey production. I think it was 2022. I'm not great with time. The Jason Byrne production with Sean McGinley, which was just absolutely mind-blowing. I thought McGinley was fabulous as Dada. But anyway, they asked me, would I respond, and I had responded to Murphy's Mom O plays previously for the Royal Irish Academy. And yeah, Murphy sort of speaks to me in ways, I think, around less around the immigration that might be pertinent to this poem, but more just in the language and in the violence and in the familiarity of the tomb landscape, one that I'm familiar with. So
maybe you'd read the poem for us then. Thanks,
okay.
Aline.
"Did Anyone Whistle? Run a bogscape of footed turf, ditches green and full, to a city where you sit in a cafe and drink tea till the rain eases. Bed sits and brick yards, bars for dreaming it different, as nights roll into a life and the past stretches. What sound does bog make when the young are gone? Or the reverberation of brothers fighting in a town full of threats? How does a fist sound as it curbs a tongue? Or a mother's voice in song moments before you left? Because after you left, and you all left, did anyone whistle? Now that we've been leaving for centuries, what sound has our leaving made? Here goes. There will be pain derived from speech off kilter, language a jitter. There will be echoes. The past holds unhurried, unhinged voices, loudest from the grave. You try to be yourself with poor precision, so now you're quick to temper and speak in story without revealing. You pummel shame to silence, and this bubbling feeling in your fists, this makes them dance. Your face now in the gutter. Oh, how indestructible you once were. An iron bridge, new railway lines, the park gates where you drank, But everything faded fast, right? And who was it said, speak well of us over beyond, and whatever ye do, let ye mind yourselves.
And that's Elaine Feeney reading her poem, Did Anyone Whistle, after Tom Murphy's A Whistle in the Dark, from her new collection, All the Good Things You Deserve. And I love the way you gave us beyond yeah. at the end of it there.
I didn't spell it phonetically that way, but I do say it that way, yeah. like the way I say yo.
Yeah, exactly. In fact, there's something of the rhythm of Tom Murphy's own speech within the way you've made that poem. I don't know whether you were familiar with his mode of delivery or not. What do you think in terms of, you know, the novels and the writing of the prose? Because there are some quite prosy style poems in this collection as well. Mm-hmm. How has the writing of the prose fed into the writing of the poetry, Elaine?
Well, you see, this fascinates me because I think I was always quite prosy in the poems, and I've maybe moved slightly more lyrical, actually. For maybe the earlier collections, you know, they were angsty and political, as you'll know, and you were a great champion of the early work as well, so thanks for that. But I think I moved into a space where I actually did look at the actual aesthetic and the beauty around the West of Ireland in a way that I hadn't earlier on. So I think actually... it's getting quite blurred because I'm working on a third novel and I notice that the poetry is really kind of seeping into it. And I'm just going to allow it because I thought I was making a very distinct difference with the prose and the poetry. But a lot of people say, I know you're a poet when I read your prose. Mm. So I think I'll just going to, I don't know. I think I'm just going to give in to language maybe.
Well, because I was convinced when I was asking you about, you know, were they absolutely discreet, the writing of the novels mm-hmm. and the writing of the... I was convinced that they would be, that they wouldn't be, that you would have been dipping in and out of it, that you might have gone and jotted a poem down, you know, as things went on. But what strikes me about this collection, and as you described it, that you certainly had to write that big title poem just mm-hmm. to get yourself started, as it were. There is that feel... perhaps of the arc that you might get in a novel, that seems to be here in some ways as well.
Yeah, that might be just a slight bit of professionalisation, finally. But no, there is. And actually, no, that was actually my own doing. And it was funny, another poet got in touch with me after reading the first cantos and he said, you write that like a mini horror story. And actually, I thought that was quite interesting, even with all the gaps in it. He said it does read like a narrative, actually.
Very strong.
A sort of a terrifying narrative. So, you know, story is important in poetry as well. Sometimes it's not always necessary. I mean, I'm very experimental and very open to experiment, you know.
Well, let us finish with the end of the arc, which thankfully in this case has a happiness to it. Do you need to tell us much about Out on the Beach once more? And for Ray, maybe you explain who Ray is, possibly.
Well, Ray is my long-suffering husband. And I've finally given in to write a few love poems. And so I'll leave you with the love poem, Out on the Beach Once More. So that's a very simple introduction. Out on the beach once more for Ray. We go back Spittle way and sit on rocks, pluck seaweed ropes, listen to the sea come and go, repeat. Here you learn to father another man's son, to raise, to be, to love. We go back to the beach today, some years since convincing ourselves we mattered. You, me, we, us, repeat. I know my love poems are unwritten. I know waves leave without words. Nothing is definite. So here is my love, fleeting, and how terrifying it is to name it.
Elaine Feeney there with her poem Out on the Beach Once More, final poem in her new collection. And Elaine, it is astonishing how sometimes it is the happy ones that pack the emotional punch as much as it is the sad ones.
That is weirdly felt that.
Absolutely beautifully. You read it beautifully and it really was very, very touching. Thanks for being with us this evening, Elaine. That's Elaine Feeney and her new collection, All the Things You Deserve, is published by Harville Secker.
And with me in studio is Pulitzer Prize winning poet, confidant of musical greats from Paul McCartney to Paul Simon, and a musician himself with his band Rogue Oliphant. He's also the master of ceremonies at his own art picnic. Here's the hint, Muldoon's picnic. Who else could I be talking about other than Paul Muldoon? Paul is, of course, first and fundamentally a poet, and his new collection is called Joy in Service en route to Gore. He brings us poems about the last wolves in Ulster. He brings us to Imperial Rome and its connection to glam rock, believe it or not, and back to his native Northern Ireland and the Belfast pogrom. We've spoken in the past. That's quite a journey that you bring us in. And that's only a few of the locations and time spans that we get to, Paul.
Yes, I mean, I do move around. I suppose the mind moves around. Yeah, I mean, there's no control over the poems. I go where they take me, you know. That's the big contract. I try to be true to them, to not to say to them, guys, you know, we shouldn't be doing that. That's not the right thing to do. I try to be at their service. I try to be open to whatever they might get up to. And so that's the bottom line, basically.
It's a kind of, you get out of the way and let the poems get on with it.
Do you know something? That is a critical phrase, and it's a phrase I find myself thinking about, if not using indeed, getting out of the way. Because the big problem with this kind of activity, and I'm sure it's true of many others, it's possibly true of broadcasting, you know, is not, as you say, not to get in the way, because one doesn't want to. I'm trying to think of a polite way of putting this. One doesn't want to mess it up, you know.
Yes.
And the problem is that we are, because we're just regular people, we're ordinary people, there's a strong chance that we will mess it up, you know. And so that is I'm fearful, actually, as I embark on a poem, often thinking, you know, I really let's hope that we that this comes out and it's going to be half okay.
I don't know if it was the last time we spoke, but certainly we spoke around the time of the whole undertaking of Paul McCartney and the lyrics in 1956 to the present. We didn't speak about it in 1956. But I'm wondering, you know, do you see that getting out of the way phrase that has kind of jumped into come to us at the beginning of this interview this evening? Is it the same for the songwriter and the poet, or do you see them as very different? Are they, as time goes on, are they closer to each other or further apart?
You know, I don't know enough about either of them to perhaps.
You've written a few poems now, in fairness.
I've tried to write a few poems. I've tried to write a few songs. Honest to God, that's as much as I ever say. But let's stick with Paul McCartney there, who definitely has written a few songs. And one of the things I really, really enjoyed hearing again and again from Paul McCartney was his absolute belief, his commitment to the idea, first of all, that he has no idea of what he's doing. You know, I used to run a class at Princeton called How to Write a Song. And during the COVID era, we always had special guests, and during the COVID era, we had a very special guest in the shape of Paul McCartney, you know, who showed up on Zoom and, you know, discussed the songs that had been written that week by the 30 or 40 students in the class. So I say to my students, the key here is you don't know what you're doing. And of course they look at me and they say, well, right, sure. But when somebody like Paul McCartney says it, as he does, I mean, they kind of sort of have to pay attention to that. And what he means by that, of course, is it's a version of not getting in the way.
Yeah.
You trust that it will do what it needs to do. Now, that doesn't mean that you're lying there kind of as an inert lump. It doesn't mean that at all. But the idea of giving oneself over to the unconscious, the subconscious is the key to this. And then negotiating with the, you've got to have some consciousness too, but it's the unconscious where the most interesting things come from.
Yeah, and I suppose being able to tap into that and knowing which bits to use and which bits that are not ready for use. There's a whole bundle of stuff we suppose we could talk about in that regard. But I'm wondering, I mean, we've mentioned Paul McCartney there. I hesitate to mention Taylor Swift in the same breath, but we do have, we had albums on Friday night last. Pillow Queens, local Irish band. Don't know if you know Pillow Queens.
I do know them actually.
And
yes,
Yvan Boland's in Name Your Sorrow. They've used that the poem Atlantis, a lost sonnet, very much as the starting point and as a key into their work on that recent album.
Yeah.
And of course, the Tortured Poet Department, an anthology from Tete, I presume you've been listening to all the time on your Spotify.
Believe it or not, I have been listening to it.
Yeah.
Absolutely, because another organ, the Guardian, the English newspaper, asked me if I'd, you know, comment on the tortured poems. You know, they're quite interesting, and she's a phenomenon, and in my own view, and the view of many, I think, poetry is a very broad church, and the more willing you are to accept that, the happier you're going to be, I think, in life. So I really hesitate from saying, you know what, that doesn't belong here.
Or you don't have a right to go near that.
Totally. Yeah. I think that's a mistake. It's a really, it's much better all round for everybody if you say, you know what, Taylor Swift is a phenomenon. I mean, what are we going to start saying? She's not?
Yeah. I think you might have, you'd be a very sticky wicket trying to argue that
totally.
Particular. Let us listen to a poem from the new collection. This one, I'm actually going to start not where I said to you a minute ago. Can we start with The River is a Wave? Because there's something about the immediacy and the simplicity of this that really struck me.
That's so nice of you to say that. Because one does want the poem to go back and read it again, perhaps. Mm. But certainly part of it's what it is trying to do. It's a bit like a radio program. You know, you want it to have some sort of immediate impact. Now, what's interesting, I might mention just for our listeners, that this poem is written in a very particular form. It's called a quatern, and it's a form I came across just in the last couple of years, and now I'm kind of obsessed by it. And the great thing about it, the interesting thing about it, is that line one in verse one or stanza one appears as line two in stanza two, and line three in stanza three, and line four in stanza four. And, you know, most people who go into the poetry business, as I'm sure you know, are just bone idle, actually, by nature. I'm certainly one of them. And the fact that you can reuse this line again and again.
I've got a line written for the next set of stanzas immediately.
Absolutely. But, you know, what's fascinating about these forms, and there are so many poetic forms, and of course that's connected to music, that do use repetition. But each time we meet it, it means something slightly different. And that is really an extraordinary. I find that really quite striking, to tell you the truth. The river is a wave. The river is a wave that never breaks, though it may briefly surge as it edges its way out of that 3-mile-long lake in which it's managed to submerge its ever so slightly diminished sense of hurt. The river is a wave that never breaks, despite such fitful spurts of enthusiasm. Let's say, for argument's sake, that if it follows in its own wake to satisfy an imperfectly remembered urge, the river is a wave that never breaks, but is forever on the verge of confronting an issue it's inclined to skirt, since it's only the sea with its incomparable ache that may categorically assert the river is a wave that never breaks.
The River is a Wave from Paul Muldoon from his new collection, Joy and Service on Route to Gore. And there must be a wonderful sense of achievement, relief, all sorts of things when you come to that final line in the fourth stanza going, it's written. That line is written. And it just, it either slots in or it doesn't. And if it doesn't slot in, then you have to go back and make sure it slots in.
Well, again, the key, if I may go back to it that you touched on earlier on, the key is, if you give it its head, if you give it, and it's, you know, it is nervous making, because you're handing yourself over to something and you don't know what's going to happen. Now, having said that, this is a poem we're talking about. You know, just suppose it doesn't work out. Is that the end of the world? No, it's not. So in some sense, the stakes are not high, right? But the chances, of something interesting might happen are real. And, you know, as I say, it's about trust.
Yeah.
That's what I try to do. I try to trust it.
The stakes are a little bit higher in the poem Near Isium. It's a set of poems, really, isn't it? It's a cycle of poems. What have we got? It's nine sections in it. This is for Andrei Kurkov, the Ukrainian novelist and writer. Are you speaking? Are you giving voice to him here, or are you speaking through him? What would you say you're doing in this poem?
Because, well,
it's quite strong politically.
Yes, it is, and you know, stronger than I suppose. As a citizen, I suppose, and you know, on for better or worse, every week brings its major issue. You know, which is not to say, by the way, that every week means that one needs to make a statement on every issue. However, there was something about I don't even want to say Russian. I'll say Putin's incursion into Ukraine. I mean, the first thing I thought, and this is really crazy, actually, the first thing I thought as a 72-year-old man was, you know, I should actually go over there. You know, what would W.H. Auden do at a time like this? Well, the smart thing is not to go over there because, you know, but that was my impulse. So,
To possibly fight, is that even what you were thinking, to be a member of the forces? Were you thinking,
well, it's
that directly?
It's madness, of course. But I, you know, this, I think what it represents, and of course there are many contenders for, you know, the most serious danger in which we might be placed, you know. But this seems to be a very, very serious scenario and one that, you know, could easily spiral absolutely out of control if it hasn't already. So anyway, I felt, you know, I would write. I mean, poems, as I was saying earlier on, come in all sorts of different forms. Most of my poems are not so, what would one say, saber-rattling or flag-waving.
That's really what struck me about it. I mean, it's on the nose, if I may use that phrase, in terms of what you're saying. I mean, at one point along the way, you say Putin, the name, and is this a translation, or you might explain it a bit to me, that the name itself means path as well as psychopath. Did I read that
correctly?
Well,
path is what it means, yeah. But, you know, I mean, I just, you know, I think there are times when, you know, the form that a poem might take may vary. It's not necessarily going to be your little lovely little musing upon some phenomenon in the natural world, you know.
Because the River and the Wave, in many ways, the River is a Wave is kind of a nature poem in many ways.
Totally. It is. That's absolutely right. So, but I think if one's demi-semi alive in the world and trying to make sense of the world and oneself in the world, which is what poets try to do, among others, then, you know, how that will present itself, how that will show itself, will probably vary from day to day and poem to poem.
And it gave you this sequence of nine, which I'm sure was not a day's work. It must have been a few months' work, I would hazard.
Yeah,
I wrote
it quite quickly, actually, because like many a poem like that, they're written in a kind of white heat, you know.
There is anger in it. You can sense that off it. Let me bring you to perhaps a less contentious place, certainly maybe closer to the place where the stakes aren't quite as high, although we might argue that they're pretty high here as well. I'm going to go to Stanley Kubrick's Spartacus, and I'm going to give you a clip here featuring Laurence Olivier as Crassus being bathed by his slave Antonius, played by Tony Curtis.
Do you eat oysters?
When I have them, master.
Do you eat snails?
No, master.
Do you consider the eating of oysters to be moral and the eating of snails to be immoral?
No, master.
Of course not. It is all a matter of taste, isn't it?
Yes, master.
And taste is not the same as appetite, and therefore not a question of morals, is it?
It could be argued so, master.
My robe, Antoninus. My taste includes both snails and oysters.
There we go, Tony Curtis and Laurence Olivier. And people are going, why on earth are they playing Spartacus? And Tony Curtis and Antoninus, in fact, is his name, as Laurence Olivier pronounced it correctly for me there. This all links in, Paul Muldoon, to a sequence at 21. Are they sonnets? I think they are sonnets. 21 sonnet sequence, or certainly a 21 poem sequence. Artichokes and Truffles.
That's right. And it began the way these things do with I came across a letter from a guy called Eddie Lewis to Kirk Douglas, which he sent on February 25th, 1959. And they're talking about Spartacus. He says, I have taken one more crack at the censors on the oysters and snail scene in Spartacus. Unfortunately, their objection to this scene is based upon the one remaining stronghold of their department, which is an absolute taboo against portrayal of homosexuality. It is possible, although they will not say for certain, that they would pass the scene if we substituted artichokes and truffles for oysters and snails. So, of course, that was enough provocation.
Yes, for you to go and do that. So you give us this big sequence of poems called Artichokes and Truffles. Can we hear poem 5 from that sequence?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to know if any of it makes sense, even if it in its entirety, but certainly if we cut a bit out of it. Let's see. When Marcus Tullius Cicero was reincarnated as Mark Bolan, it was as if a jeep had indeed dated a Jaguar. There was a time when my old friend Beep was Bolan's publicist and therefore able to reap the benefits of the rock and roll lifestyle. The learning curve is spectacularly steep when you're living in a stately pile. It was, after all, Cicero who categorized the style of Caesar's Gallic Wars as nude. The term file derives from phylum and may well refer to the metallic thread beloved of so many of those chaps who might well be into them old assless chaps. But the perfect rhyme there on chaps and chaps, I'm a devotee of, among others, the great Lord Byron. Mm. And, you know, that's the kind of rhyme. It's the perfect rhyme, of course. You can't do better than chaps. Chaps is the perfect rhyme there. But
you did rhyme in another poem, Moth the Hopple,
with Aristotle, which to me was the most exciting rhyme in the book for me. Or is that a half rhyme? It probably is a half rhyme.
Well, you know, I'm so glad you like that. And, you know, I mean, there's no, as we know, there's no intrinsic merit in rhyme. But I'm one of those old, what would one say, dinosaurs, certainly for many people, who, you know, still believe that there's something, there's some fun to be had. There's some actually quite often some discovery to be made through a rhyme. Something that will actually affect how we look at the world might be made through it. You know, for many, the idea of rhyme went out at least 100 years ago, if not longer ago. I myself don't fall into that category, or more accurately, my poems don't.
Yeah.
And they seem to want to, more often than not, come into the world in those traditional forms.
And Mark Bolan arrives there. Did he arrive unannounced, unexpected, and you got out of the way and let him into the poem, or the poem insisted that he was there?
He did. I mean, as it turns out, I mean, I was a huge fan of Mark Bolan when I was a teenager, and you know, I tried to play Mark Bolan on both. I was influenced also by the Dubliners, and I tried to play Mark Bolan on both the G banjo and the tenor banjo, and the only thing I discovered is that it doesn't quite work. But you know,
is this with the Rogue Elephant? Yeah.
No. Well, it was by myself when I was a child. But I was trying to merge the Dubliners and Tyrannosaurus or T-Rex. But in any case, so, you know, popular culture.
Mm.
Popular culture is a feature in many of my poems. And funnily enough, Mark Bolan's producer, the remarkable Tony Visconti, who's mentioned in the poem, funnily enough, he has just produced... The band that I worked with has just produced our new album, which I had no idea would happen when I wrote this poem. So, you know, it's a strange world.
You talk about the poems almost as if they're a separate entity from you.
Yeah.
Just explain that a bit further to me, because obviously, and I think if I heard you properly earlier on, you were saying you're not, it's not as if you're some kind of passive vessel that the poems drive through onto the page. So what is the relationship?
So I am not a passive vessel. I'm not. However, I'm smart enough to know that the chances of the poem has a better chance of doing something interesting than I do. So I see what it might be trying to do, insofar as I can judge it. And I do feel, I mean, I don't, I say it again and again, I know people look askance, but it seems to be the case that I don't really write these poems, you know. You know, I by way of example, I'm sure most people, and perhaps I hope a few people listening to this might remember an essay they wrote when they were 15 at school, and they come back and they read it. And they look at it and they think, wow, who wrote that?
I
don't know if you've had that experience.
Well, yeah, see, there are things like that in one's life, I think, for several people, yeah.
Exactly. And you look at it and you think, who wrote that? I couldn't have written that. It's too smart for anything I would have ever written. There's something else at work here. There's some other force. And so it's the harnessing of that force, or the acceptance of that force, which is the business that I'm in.
We'll finish up with a poem, which, because it has to be said, all those things that you're talking about, your love of rhyme, and that when you explain the quatrain term to us with that, the line that moves down the stanza, there's a great sense of fun in that as well. And it's an enjoyment to the ear as well as to the eye when you look at it on the page. This, by the time you read this, is what I want you to finish up with, if you don't mind, on page 66, if you have it there. It kind of struck me as I thought, is this how a Pulitzer Prize-winning poet starts to write a note at home to say I'm just gone down to the shop, but it becomes something else. That's what it felt like to me. Maybe totally miles away from how the poem happened.
No, not at all. That's certainly the what would one say, the format that it's using. And there are a number of poems that take the form of notes. I mean, one of the most famous ones is William Carlos Williams' poem, This Is Just to Say, which looks as if it might be a poem that's been left on a fridge door. It's the one about, this is just to say I've eaten the, whatever it was, the plums that were in the icebox. You know, they were delicious, so sweet and so cold. So this one is certainly, it is a little bit of a remake of a poem I wrote. It was the title poem of a book that came out in 1980, which was called Why Brownlee Left. And it's a kind of, it certainly has to do with a similar kind of phenomenon of the guy who goes out, not only guys, the people who go out, you know, to buy the Sunday Independent and are never seen again. For whatever reason. So, by the time you read this, I'll be gone for a newspaper and quart of milk, never to return. A half-mowed lawn leading to me as a scroll of silk once led to the mulberry silkworm. By the time you read this, I'll be gone AWOL. In spite of the fact, in terms of domesticity, I've outshone even the heedful trumpeter swan that spends 5 weeks constructing a nest. By the time you read this, I'll be gone, less because of some profound unrest than my fascination with the Cree and the sandhills of Saskatchewan, into which windswept immensity, by the time you read this, I'll be long gone.
There you go. And it's the quatrain again, that form again, with a slight variation in that final line. Paul, thanks so much for being in with us this evening. Thanks for a really interesting conversation.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Paul Muldoon talking to us there about his new collection, Joy and Service on Rue to Gore, which is published by Faber. Egg Shell is the second collection of poems from Cork poet Victoria Kenneth Fick. Her first collection, Eat or We Both Starve, focused on subjects like eating disorders, Catholicism and Irish history, and went on to win the Seamus Heaney Prize for Best First Collection in 2022. And it was shortlisted for the T.S. Eliot Prize. In her new collection, she continues to dive deep and explores a number of emotional themes, from early motherhood and miscarriage to the impact of a spouse's gender transition and the dissolution of a marriage. Delighted to be joined now by Victoria Kenefick to discuss these issues. I mean, I remember with Eat or We Both Starve thinking this really is a poet bearing her heart to us in that particular collection. This second collection, even more so, incredibly difficult topics that you had to address. Was there no choice but to address them in the collection, Victoria?
I don't think for me and the project that I seem to be engaged in as a poet that there was much of a choice, because I'm so concerned with exploring all of the aspects of what it is to be human. And I just so happen to be this human and these things are happening to me and I almost feel duty bound to explore them. And poetry seems always to me a very useful, beautiful and adaptable vehicle to explore things that maybe in our everyday common parlance are actually very difficult to talk about and incredibly, incredibly complicated, specifically, I suppose, with the issues that the book explores.
Well, it's divided into two sections. And do you call it, by the way, just egg? And then I'm leaving a bit of a pause before I say shell, but it's actually written as egg stroke shell. What do you call the collection?
I really like the dramatic pause in between. I like the egg and then significant eye contact and then shell. So that's what I've been going with.
Yeah. No, I can see how that would work. The egg part, the egg is such a, I suppose, in many ways, potent symbol, and it's all about growth and new life. Explain to us what was to the fore of your mind in this particular part of the book.
So initially, I suppose when I began the project, I was thinking very much on focusing on early motherhood and secondary infertility, which is something that I hadn't really seen explored before and didn't really know much about until it was something that I experienced myself. And the egg just seemed like such a wonderful vehicle for that. Obviously, as you say, a very significant, in fact, the symbol of fertility. But also there was something about how strong it was, but also that it contains multitudes and has so many possibilities. And cracking an egg, you know, you can make something out of it or a new creature emerges. So it provided a really useful way for me to come at something that was difficult and that was challenging. And it was interesting then where that led me, obviously, in the second part of the collection.
Yeah, I noticed in that first section we have dotted throughout the first section we have poems. Number one, Ivy. Number two, Fern. Number three, I don't know if I can find in my notes here, I can't find, but I think there is it three or four wildflowers that we get mentioned specifically here. Explain what they are or what they represent.
Well, ultimately, I suppose having had four miscarriages myself after having a wonderful, healthy, exuberant child without difficulty. It was such a strange experience because some of those losses were during lockdown as well. And I really felt this bizarre grief where, you know, you're grieving something that hasn't happened, but your body isn't aware of that. So your body is all gearing up for this event and it takes a while for it to step down. And I found myself in this very strange liminal space where I was not, you know, going to meet these children, but equally I could feel their presence. So I thought it best to give them names and to in some way commemorate the fact that they existed even as a cell, even briefly, for me, if nobody else.
Yeah, well, I know it's a beautiful way of remembering them in that fashion. Will you set up as an early poem in that this first section, Night Baby, for us?
Of course. This poem is dedicated to my daughter. And I think early motherhood is incredibly difficult for everyone. And I found it very, very challenging in multiple ways. And one of the things that I found hardest, I suppose, was sleep. And the fact that it's not something you can make somebody do. It's not something that you can force upon anyone. And particularly with babies, they become different creatures. So I had in my head this, you know, to try and understand it, a night baby and a day baby. So this is my attempt, I suppose, to bring peace to that night baby and also find solace in the fact that there's this whole community of people up at night for various reasons. And even though we might feel very alone, we're all there together.
Let's hear Night Baby. So,
Night Baby. I've never thought about the moon so much, considered it sister-like, watching us learn how to be together. You in my arms, perfect circle of your small mouth pressed to my breast. Lunar light from my phone, my own brain, the moon all shining. It's scary how big the night is, how small we are in it. Think of the others up with us, a night nation of milk and mouths all fumbling towards each other in the dark, singing. The shape of you, a crescent against me, little planet exploring your phases. Oh moon, be good to her in the ebb and flow of monthly life. Lick the path clean. But for now, sweet night baby, rock with me.
Night Baby from Egg Shell, the new collection from Victoria Kennefic. I mentioned that obviously the egg is the first part of the collection. The second part of the collection, Shell, deals predominantly with your spouse, your former spouse. There's a wonderful, I've read where you explained what Shell actually has a particular potent meaning within the trans community.
Absolutely. And this is one of those things, I think, where poetry can be such a gift and following particular motifs and patterns and images can really provide solace and understanding. So when my former spouse came out as trans, my natural reaction is to research when I'm in crisis and to try and understand what is happening and know as much as I can about it. And when I did my research, I found that in the trans community, a really lovely kind of way of speaking about somebody who doesn't know they're trans and hasn't realised yet is to refer to them as an egg. And once that epiphany has happened and they realise that they're trans, their egg cracks. So there's no going back and something beautiful emerges. But equally, something is fragmented and shattered and broken to facilitate this growth and this movement towards their true and authentic selves. So that was just an incredible moment for me when I was writing the book, because I didn't know where I was going to go with the rest of the egg part. And then suddenly there was this pathway or this kind of possibility of moving towards that symbol.
Will you read a poem that's from that second section then, which really struck me when I read it? The title of the poem is "On Wondering Whether to Expunge the Word Husband from My Previous Poems."
I will, Sean. On wondering whether to expunge the word husband from my previous poems. I go back and count the number of times I have used the words husband, he, my husband in my poems. It isn't very often, but I am struck by what that H represents. Perpendicular lines, the walls, that horizontal roof under which we all sheltered, safe, the scaffold, the twig-like structure boxing us in. I thought I was happy. I thought he was happy too. That structure didn't hold. It collapsed, just like the straw house, like the stick house when the wolf blew and blew. There are no bricks anymore. I am not the wife. That W, a roller coaster of a letter. I've fallen down its side. I promise I won't use that word again for you. I'm glad your new name makes you happy, the way husband never could.
Victoria Kennefic with "On Wondering Whether to Expunge the Word Husband from My Previous Poems." This is from her new collection, Egg Shell. It must have been an incredibly difficult and emotional time when the person you love finds themselves in the situation that your spouse found themselves in, and then you have to process that in some way. What did your writing provide for you in the midst of all of that, Victoria?
I think, as is so often the case with poetry, it was a saving grace and a place where I could, I think, explore that processing, because I don't think that's something that people tend to speak about in this situation, is that obviously your brain is a physical entity and it has created neural pathways through familiarity and use of a particular name and particular pronouns and so on. So you literally, I certainly had to train my brain to make this switch from seeing this person as one person to the person that they truly and beautifully are. And so that is hard. It's actually work. And so I think in writing about it, it allowed me to get used to that transition that I was making. Because I think when somebody changes, and no matter what the change is, everyone else around them changes too. And so you either embrace that and accept it and use it as a way of developing your own personality and your own personal experience, or you push against it and reject it. And it's okay to live in that space in between as well, which I think in some parts of the book, there is that kind of grappling with what road am I going to take, or the speaker is going to take. And so I think poetry is, because of its form, because of the language it provides, because of its symbolism and imagery, it is a scaffolding. It is a machine. It's almost like a container for those feelings and experiences that, you know, as I said previously, maybe more literal language has shortcomings in that regard, because it is just a very existential experience. In terms of even looking back at memories now I've had with the person, you know, they're altered. And I'm not sure which is the real one and what is real anyway when it comes to memory. So I, once again, always so grateful for poetry.
Yeah, and there's a lovely poem where you talk about getting phone calls and where you've changed the person's name, obviously, in your contacts, and you're constantly asking, who is she, when that name comes up on your contacts, which I thought it shows us the humanity of the situation. However, you might finish with a poem, because swans play a big part in the collection as well. And this poem, Cygnus, the Swain and the Stars, in some ways talks about a transition of your own, I think.
Exactly. And I think swans have always been such an important animal. For me, they've been there with me through my life in various different guises. I've had very strange experiences yeah. with swans. And I think there's something about their grace on the water and their clumsiness on land that really resonates with me, because they also contain multitudes. Right. So this is my, I suppose, attempt to move through my own, as you say, my own change. Cygnus, the swan in the stars. Is there anything to be said for gathering your own bones, being responsible like that, and taking the poor, tired, and battered corpse of who you once were from its treacherous position and giving it a proper burial so it can ascend? The sting is there'll have to be a transition from one form to another. So I take the shape of a swan with large, powerful wings and a long, slender neck. My feet webbed to swim to those unimaginable depths where my earthly remains lie shattered. I'll retrieve them and put them in the ground. She was only human, engraved on my headstone. I am hoping to find my place in the sky, a swan in the stars, wings spread wide, majestic, immortal.
And that's Victoria Kenefick reading her poem Cygnus the Swan in the Stars, and that from her new collection Egg Shell, which is published by Carcanet Press. And let's finish tonight's Arenas Olympiad with some music.
Don't fear the night. Embrace the moonlight. There will be stars above you to guide you through with their glittering light. Don't fear the night. Just close.